Patty Day. January 2, 1985. 3:10 p.m. Patty flew into the driver's seat of Diane's car, her eyes on the keys dangling from the ignition. Get out of here, now. Get out. Diane hopped into the passenger side as Patty turned over the engine. She actually made a burned rubber noise as she squealed away from the Mueller's house, the rear end of the car flailing behind her. All the crap in Diane's trunk, baseballs and garden tools and the girls' dolls, rolled and banged like passengers in a turnover wreck. She and Diane bumped along the gravel road, dust flying, skidding toward the trees on the left and then veering toward a ditch on the right. Finally, Diane's strong hand appeared and landed gently on the wheel. Easy. Patty rumbled along until she got off the Mueller property, swung a wide left, pulled to the side of the road, and cried, fingers grasped around the wheel, her head on the center causing an aborted honk. What the hell is going on? She shrieked. It was a child's tear scream, wet, enraged, and baffled. Some strange stuff, Diane said, patting her back. Let's get you home. I don't want to go home. I need to find my son. The word son started her weeping again, and she let it rip, gulping sobs and thoughts jabbing her like needles. He'd need a lawyer. They didn't have money for a lawyer. He'd get some bored county guy appointed to him. They'd lose. He'd go to jail. What would she tell the girls? How long did someone go away for something like that? 5 years? 10? She could see a big prison parking lot, the gates opening, and her Ben gingerly walking out, 25 years old, frightened of the open space, eyes narrowed against the light. He comes near her, her arms open, and he spits on her for not saving him. How do you live with not being able to save your son? Could she send him away, on the run, fugitive? How much money could she even give him? In December, numb from exhaustion, she'd sold her dad's 45 auto to Linda Boyler. She could picture Dave Boyler, who she'd never liked, opening it up Christmas morning. This gun he didn't earn. So Patty, right now, had almost $300 squirreled away in the house. It was all owed to others. She'd planned on making her first-of-the-month rounds later today. But that wouldn't happen now. Plus, $300 would only keep Ben going a few months.
Ben will come home when he finishes blowing off steam, Diane reasoned. How far can he get on a bike in January?
What if they find him first?
Sweetheart, there's no mob after him. You heard the Mueller boys didn't even know about the accusation. They were talking about other bullshit rumors. We need to talk to Ben to straighten this out. But for all we know, he could be home right now.
Who's the family that's saying he did this?
No one said.
You can find out, though. They can't just say things like that and expect us to lie down and take it, right? You can find out. We have a right to know who's saying this. Ben has a right to confront his accuser. I have a right.
Fine. Let's go back to the house, check in on the girls, and I'll make some calls. Now will you let me drive?
They walked into pure din. Michelle was trying to fry salami strips on the skillet, screaming at Debbie to go away. Libby had a splatter of bright pink burns up one arm and a cheek where the grease had hit her, and was sitting on the floor, mouth wide, crying the way Patty had just been crying in the car, as if there was absolutely no hope, and even if there was, she wasn't up to the challenge. Patty and Diane moved like they were choreographed, one of those German clocks with the fancy men and women dancing in and out. Diane strode to the kitchen in three big steps and yanked Michelle away from the stove, dragging her by the one arm, doll-like, to the living room, depositing her on the sofa with a swat on her tush. Patty crisscrossed them, swooped up Libby, who monkey wrapped herself around her mother and continued crying into her neck. Patty turned on Michelle, who was losing fat, silent tears.
I told you, you may only use the stove to heat soup. You could have set this whole place on fire.
Michelle glanced around the shabby kitchen and living room as if wondering whether that would be a loss.
We were hungry, Michelle mumbled. You've been gone forever.
And that means you need a fried salami sandwich your mom told you not to make?
Snapped Diane, finishing up the frying, slapping the meat on a plate.
She needs you to be good girls right now.
She always needs us to be good girls, Debbie mumbled.
She was nuzzling a pink stuffed panda that Ben had won years ago at the Cloud County Fair. He'd knocked down a bunch of milk bottles, just as his preteen muscles were coming in. The girls had celebrated as if he'd won a Medal of Honor. The days never won anything. They always said that, marveling, whenever they had a tiny piece of good luck.
We never win anything.
It was the family motto. And is it really so hard to be good? Diane gave Debbie a soft chuck under her chin, and Debbie lowered her gaze even more as she started to smile.
I guess not.
Diane said she'd make the calls, grabbing the kitchen phone and pulling it all the way down the hall as far as it could go.
As she walked away, she told Patty to feed her dang children, the words riling Patty, as if she was so negligent she often forgot meals. Make tomato soup from ketchup and milk from a powder? Yes.
Toast some stale bread, add a squirt of mustard and call it a sandwich? Yes. On the worst days? Yes. But she never forgot. The kids were on the free lunch program at school, so they always got something there at least. Even as she thought this, she felt worse. Because Patty went to the same school as a kid, and she never had to do the half lunch or free lunch, and now her stomach knotted as she remembered the free lunch kids and her patronizing smiles toward them as they presented their dog-eared cards, and the steamy cafeteria ladies would call it out, "Free lunch!" And the boy next to her, buzz-haired and confident, would whisper inanely, "There's no such thing as a free lunch." And she'd feel sorry for the kids, but not in a way that made her want to help, just in a way that made her not want to look at them anymore. Libby was still heaving and crying in her arms. Patty's neck was sweaty from the girl's hot breaths. After twice asking Libby to look at her, the girl finally blinked and turned her face up to her mother's.
I got burned.
Then she started crying again.
Baby, baby, it's just a few ouchies. It won't be permanent. Is that what you're worried about? They're just some little pink ouchies. You won't even remember next week. Something bad's gonna happen.
Libby was her worrier. She came out of the womb wary and stayed that way. She was the nightmare girl, the fretter. She was an out-of-nowhere pregnancy. Neither Patty nor Runner were happy. They didn't even bother with a baby shower. Their families were so sick of them procreating that the entire pregnancy was an embarrassment. Libby must have marinated in anxious stomach acid for 9 months, soaking up all that worry. Potty training her was surreal. She screamed when she saw what came out of her, ran away naked and frantic. Dropping her off at school had always been an act of utter abandonment. Her daughter with the giant wet eyes, face pressed against the glass, as a kindergarten teacher restrained her. This past summer she refused to eat for a week, turned white and haunted, and then finally, revealed to Patty a pot of warts that had sprouted on one knee.
Eyes down in slow sentences that Patty extracted from her over the course of an hour, Libby explained that she thought the warts might be like poison ivy, that they'd eventually cover her and, sob, no one would be able to see her face anymore. And when Patty had asked why in the world hadn't Libby told her these worries before, Libby just looked at her like she was crazy. Whenever possible, Libby prophesied doom. Patty knew that, but the words still made her clench. Something bad had already happened, but it would get worse.
She sat with Libby on the couch, smoothing her hair, patting her back. Debbie and Michelle hovered near, fetching tissues for Libby and fussing over her the way they should have done a good hour ago. Debbie tried to make the panda pretend talk to Libby, telling her she was okay, but Libby shoved it away and turned her head. Michelle asked if she could cook everyone soup. They ate soup all through the winter, Patty keeping giant vats of it in the freezer locker in the garage. They usually ran out right around the end of February. February was the worst month. Michelle was dumping a big frozen square of beef and vegetables into a stew pot, cracking off the ice, ignoring the plate of salami, when Diane returned with her mouth tugged into a grimace. She lit a cigarette. "Trust me, I need it," and sat down on the sofa, her weight bumping up Patty and Libby like a seesaw. She sent the girls into the kitchen with Michelle, the kids not saying anything, obedient in their nervousness. "Okay, so it's this family named Cates that started it. They live halfway between here and Salina. Send their kid to Kinnicky because the public school's not finished in their suburb. So it started because Ben was doing after-school volunteering with the Cates girl. Did you know he was volunteering?" Patty shook her head. "Volunteering?" Diane pushed her lips out. Didn't jive with her either. "Well, for whatever reason, he was volunteering with these young kids in the elementary school. And this girl's parents say something wrong went on between them. And so do some others. The Hinkles, the Putches, and the Cahills."
"What?"
"They're all comparing notes. They've all talked to the school. From what I hear, the police are involved, and you should expect someone, a cop, to come by today to talk to you and Ben. It's reached that stage. Not everyone at school knows. We're lucky this happened on Christmas break. But I guess after today that won't be the case. I guess any kid who Ben helped after school, the school is talking to the parents. So, like, 10 families.
"What should I do?"
Patty put her head between her knees. She felt laughter in her stomach. It was all so ludicrous.
"I wonder if I'm having a breakdown," she thought.
"Maybe I could have a breakdown and then I won't have to talk to anyone." A safe white room, and Patty being ushered like a child from breakfast to lunch to dinner, maneuvered by people with gentle whispers, Patty shuffling like someone who's dying.
"I guess everyone's over at the Cates place, talking right now," Diane said. "I got the address."
Patty just stared.
"I think we should go over there," Diane said.
"Go over there? I thought you said someone would come here."
"The phone's been ringing off the hook," Michelle said. Michelle, who'd been in the kitchen and shouldn't have heard any of this. Patty and Diane both turned to the phone, waiting for it to go off.
"Well, why didn't you answer it like we asked, Michelle?"
Diane said. Michelle shrugged.
"I forgot if we were supposed to or not."
"Maybe we should wait here," Patty said.
"Patty, those families are over there talking shit about your son. Now who knows what kernel of truth may be in there or not. But don't you want to go speak for him? Don't you want to hear what they're saying? Make them say it to our face?"
No, she didn't. She wanted the stories to go away, nice and quiet, creep back into oblivion. She didn't want to hear what people in her town, Maggie Hinkle went to high school with her for Pete's sake, were saying about Ben. And she was afraid she'd crumble with all those furious faces on her. She'd weep, beg for forgiveness. Already, all she wanted was forgiveness.
and they hadn't even done anything wrong.
Let me put on some better clothes.
She found a sweater without rips in the armpits and a pair of khaki slacks. She ran a comb through her hair and exchanged her gold studs for a pair of imitation pearl earrings and matching necklace. You really couldn't tell they were fake. They even felt heavy. As she and Diane went toward the front door, further admonishments about using the stove, a request to turn off the TV and do chores at some point, Libby began wailing again, running toward them with her arms flapping. Michelle crossed her arms over her stained sweatshirt and stomped a foot.
"I can't deal with her when she's like this," she said in a perfect imitation of Patty. "She's too much. It's too much for me."
Patty took a breath in, thought about reasoning with Michelle, thought about bullying Michelle. But Libby was bawling louder, a howling animal, screaming,
"I want to go with you, I want to go with you."
Michelle arching an eyebrow. Patty pictured a cop showing up here while she was away, a burnt-faced, weeping child lying inconsolable on the floor. Should she take all three then? But someone should be here to answer the phone, to be here. And it was probably better to have both Michelle and Debbie here than... "Libby, go put on your boots," Diane ordered. "Michelle, you are in charge. Answer the phone, don't answer the door. If it's Ben, he'll have a key. If it's someone else, we don't want you two worrying about it. Michelle."
"What's going on?"
"Michelle, I'm not messing with you. Michelle."
"Okay."
"Okay," Diane said. And that, literally, was the final word. Patty stood in the hallway, useless, watching Libby put on her boots and a pair of dirt-caked mittens. Patty grabbed one woolly hand and walked her toward the car. It might be good, anyway, if people were reminded Ben had little sisters who loved him. Libby wasn't a big talker. Michelle and Debbie seemed to hog all her words. She made pronouncements. "I like ponies. I hate spaghetti. I hate you." Like her mother, she had no poker face, no poker mood. It was all right there. When she wasn't angry or sad, she just didn't say much. Now, seat-belted in back, taken along for the ride, she sat silently, her pink, blotched face aimed out the window, a finger against the glass, tracing the tops of trees outside. Neither Patty nor Diane spoke either, and the radio stayed off. Patty tried to picture the visit. Visit? Could you really call something this repulsive a visit? But all she could see was her screaming, "Leave my son alone!" She and Maggie Hinkle had never been friends, but they'd always exchanged conversation at the grocery store, and the Putches she knew from church. These weren't unkind people. They wouldn't be unkind to her. As for the parents of the first girl, Chrissy Cates, Patty had no idea. She pictured the Cateses as brightly blonde and preppy, with everything matching and the house pristine and smelling of potpourri. She wondered if Mrs. Cates would spot the fake pearls. Diane guided her off the highway and into the neighborhood, past a big blue sign boasting of model units and Elkwood Park. So far, it was just blocks and blocks of wooden skeletons, each one an outline of a house, each one allowing you to see the outline of the one next to it and the outline of the one next to that. A teenage girl sat smoking on the second floor of one skeleton house. She looked like Wonder Woman in her invisible plane, sitting in the outlines of a bedroom. When she tapped her cigarette, the ashes fluttered down into the dining room. All the pre-houses unnerved Patty. They were recognizable but totally foreign, an everyday word you suddenly couldn't remember to save your life. "Pretty, huh?" Diane said, wagging a finger at the neighborhood. Two more turns and they were there, a block of tidy houses, real houses, a cluster of cars in front of one. "Looks like a party," Diane sniffed. She rolled down the window and spat outside. The car was silent for a few seconds, except for Diane's throat noises. "Solidarity," Diane said. "Don't worry. Worst they can do is yell."
"Maybe you should stay here with Libby," Patty said. "I don't want yelling in front of her."
"Nah," Diane said. "No one stays in the car. We can do this. Yeah, Libby? You're a tough little girl, right?"
Diane turned her bulk to Libby in the back seat, her parka rustling, and then back to Patty.
"It'll be good for them to see her. Know he's got a little sister around who loves him."
Patty had a shot of confidence that she'd thought the same thing. Diane was out of the car then, on the other side, rousting Libby, and opening the door wide for her to get out. The three of them walked up the sidewalk, Patty immediately feeling ill. Her ulcers had been quiet for a bit, but now her belly burned. She had to unclench her jaw and work it loose. They stood on the doorstep, Patty and Diane in front, with Libby just behind her mother, glancing out backward. Patty imagined a stranger driving past, thinking they were friends joining the festivities. The door still had a Christmas wreath on it. Patty thought, they had a nice, happy Christmas, and now they are frightened and angry, and I bet they keep thinking, but we just had such a nice, happy Christmas.
The house was like something from a catalog, and there were two BMWs in the driveway, and these were not people who were used to bad things happening.
"I don't want to do this. I don't think we should do this," she blurted.
Diane rang the doorbell and gave her a look straight from their dad, the calm, unmoved look he gave whiners. Then she said exactly what Dad always said when he gave the look. Nothing to it but to do it. Mrs. Cates answered the door, blonde and prairie-faced. Her eyes were red from crying, and she was holding a tissue.
"Hello. May I help you?" Are you Chrissy Cates's mother?"
Patty started and began crying.
"I am," the woman said, fingers on her own pearls, her eyes shifting back and forth to Patty and Diane, and then down to Libby. "Oh, was your little girl... did he hurt your little girl, too?"
"No," Patty said. "I'm Ben's mother. I'm Ben Day's mother." She wiped the tears with the back of her hand, then with the sleeve of her sweater.
"Oh, God. Oh, God. Oh, Lou! Come here. Hurry!"
Mrs. Cates's voice grew loud and quivery, the sound of an airplane going down. Several faces Patty didn't recognize peered around the corner of the living room. A man walked past from the kitchen holding a tray of sodas. One girl lingered in the hallway, a pretty blonde girl wearing flowered jeans.
"Who's that?"
the girl chirped.
"Go get your father."
Mrs. Cates moved to fill up the doorway, almost physically pushing them from the doorstep.
"Lou!"
she called back into the house. A man appeared behind her, slab-like, 6'5" at least, solid, with a way of keeping his chin up that reminded Patty of people who got what they wanted.
"This is her. This is Ben Day's mother,"
the woman said with such disgust Patty could feel her womb flinch.
"You'd better come inside," the man said. And when Patty and Diane glanced at each other, he snapped, "Come, come!"
like they were bad pets. They stepped into the home, into a sunken den, and peered out on a scene that looked like a children's birthday party. Four girls were in various states of play. They wore foil stars on their faces and hands, the kind of stickers teachers used to mark good grades. Several were sitting with their parents, eating cake. The girls looking greedy,
the moms and dads looking panicked behind brave faces. Chrissy Cates had plopped herself in the middle of the floor and was playing dolls with a large, dark-haired young man who sat cross-legged in front of her, ingratiating himself. They were those spongy, unpretty dolls Patty had seen in movies of the week, with Meredith Baxter Burney or Patty Duke Aston as determined mothers or lawyers. They were the dolls that kids used to show how they were abused. Chrissy had stripped the clothes off both dolls and was placing the boy doll on top of the girl doll. She bumped it up and down and chanted nonsense words. A brunette girl watched from her mother's lap while eating icing from under her fingernails. She seemed too old to be in her mother's lap. "Like that," Chrissy concluded, bored or angry, and tossed the doll aside. The young man, a therapist, a social worker, someone who wore Shetland sweaters with plaid shirts underneath, someone who went to college, picked the doll back up and tried to get Chrissy's attention. "Chrissy, let's," he said, holding the boy doll carefully off one knee, the doll's penis drooping toward the floor. "Who is that?" Chrissy said, pointing at Patty. Patty strode across the room, ignoring all the parents, who began standing, wavering like strummed wires. "Chrissy," she said, crouching down on the floor. "My name is Patty. I'm Ben Day's mom." Chrissy's eyes widened, her lips quivered, and she scooted away from Patty. There was a second of silence, like a slow-motion crash, where she and Patty stared at each other. Then Chrissy tilted her head back and yelled, "I don't want her here!" Her voice echoed off the skylight. "I don't want her here! You said I wouldn't have to!" She threw herself on the floor and began ripping at her hair. The brunette girl ran over and wrapped herself over Chrissy, wailing, "I don't feel safe." Patty stood up, spinning around the room, saw parents with frightened, revolted faces, saw Diane hustling Libby behind her toward the door.
"We've heard about you,"
Chrissy Cates's mother said, her sweet, drained face twisted into a ball. She motioned back to Maggie Hinkle, Patty's old classmate, who blushed at Patty.
"You've got 4 kids at home," she continued, her voice tight, her eyes wet. "You can't afford a one of them. Their daddy's a drunk. You're on welfare. You leave your girls alone with that jackal. You let your son prey on girls. Jesus Christ, you've let your son do this. God knows what happens out there."
The Putsch girl stood and screamed then, tears rolling past bright stars on her cheeks. She joined the pack in the middle, where the young man was murmuring soothing words, trying to maintain eye contact with them.
"I don't want them here,"
Chrissy yelled again.
"Where's Ben, Patty?" Maggie Hinkle said, her spade-faced daughter sitting beside her, expressionless. "The police really need to talk to Ben. I hope you're not hiding him."
"Me? I've been trying to find him. I'm trying to straighten this out. Please.
Please help me. Please forgive me. Please stop screaming." Maggie Hinkle's daughter remained quiet, then tugged at her mother's sleeve.
"Mom, I want to leave."
The other girls continued to howl, watching each other. Patty stood, looking down at Chrissy and the therapist, who was still cradling the naked doll boy that was supposed to be Ben. Her stomach seized, flushed her throat with acid.
"I think you should leave,"
snapped Mrs. Cates, picking up her daughter like a toddler, the girl's legs dangling almost to the floor, Mrs. Cates wobbling with the weight. The young therapist stood up, inserting himself between Patty and Mrs. Cates. He almost put a hand on Patty, then moved it to Mrs. Cates instead. Diane was calling from the door, calling Patty's name, or Patty wouldn't have known to move. She was waiting for them to close in on her, scratch her eyes out.
"I'm sorry. I'm sorry,"
Patty was yelling into the room, frantic and dizzy.
"It's a mistake. I'm so sorry."
Then Lou Cates was in front of her, grabbing her by the arm as if he hadn't just invited her in, and walking her toward the door, the keening of four girls behind her. Mothers and dads were everywhere, grown-ups taking care of their children. And Patty felt stupid, not foolish, not embarrassed, unforgivably stupid. She could hear the parents cooing things to their daughters. "Good girl. It's okay, it's okay. She's leaving now. You're safe. We'll make this all better. Hush, hush, baby." Just before Lou Cates propelled her from the room, Patty turned around to see Chrissy Cates in her mother's arms, her blonde hair over one eye. The girl looked at her and said simply, "Ben is going to hell."
Libby Day, now. I'd been commissioned to find Runner, but all my feverish, ambitious action of the past week was slopped on the floor next to my bed like a soiled nightgown. I couldn't get up, even when I heard the kids make their sleepy duck walk past my house. I pictured them in big rubber rain boots, clomping along, leaving rounded footprints in the March muck, and I still couldn't move. I'd woken up from a miserable dream, the kind you keep telling yourself doesn't mean anything, shouldn't bother you, because it's just a dream, just a dream. It started back at the farm, but it wasn't the farm, really. It was far too bright, too tidy to be the farm, but it was, and in the distance, against an orange horizon, Runner was galloping toward the farm, hooting like an Old West cowboy. As he got closer, down our hill, through the gate, I saw that his gallop was actually a rickety bump-along motion, because his horse had wheels. Its top half was flesh, but the bottom was metal, spindly, like a hospital gurney. The horse whinnied at me in panic, its muscled neck trying to separate from the metal below. Runner leapt down, the creature rolling away, one wheel busted, an irritating grocery cart of an animal. It came to a stop near a tree stump, its eyes going white, still struggling to pull itself apart.
"Don't worry about that," Runner grinned at the horse. "I paid for it."
"You got a bad deal," I said. Runner's jaw tightened, and he stood too close to me.
"Your mom says it's fine," he muttered.
"That's right," I thought. "My mom is alive." The idea felt solid, like a pebble in my pocket. My mom was alive, and how foolish I'd been all these years thinking otherwise.
"You'd better fix your hand first," Runner said, pointing at my stumped ring finger. "I brought you these. Hope you like them better than the horse."
He held up a flimsy velvet bag, the kind used for Scrabble, and shook it. "Oh, I love the horse," I said, batting away my ill will. The horse had torn its hindquarters from the metal and was bleeding a meaty red oil onto the ground. From his bag, Runner poured 8 or 9 fingers. Every time I picked one that looked like mine, I realized it was a pinky finger, a man's finger, a finger of the wrong color or size. Runner was pursing his lips at me.
"Just take one, okay? It's not a big deal."
I picked one that was vaguely similar to my lost one, and Runner sewed it to my hand, the ripped horse screaming now behind us, a woman's scream, terrified and angry. Runner threw a shovel at it, and it broke in two, pulsing on the ground, unable to move.
"There," Runner said with a lip smack, "good as new."
Between my two girlish fingers, a bulbous big toe squatted, tied on with lazy, thick stitches,
And suddenly, Runner's girlfriend Peggy was there and said, "Honey, your mom is not here, remember? We killed her." And Runner smacked his head like a man who'd forgotten to bring home milk and said, "That's right, that's right. I got all them girls, except Libby." We three stood blinking at each other, the air turning nasty. Then Runner went back to the horse and picked up the shovel, which had become an axe. I flung myself awake, one arm cracking my bedside lamp to the floor. It was barely dawn when I turned and watched the glowing lamp on its side, wondered if the light bulb would burn a hole in the carpet. Now it was morning, and still I couldn't move. But the light was on in Ben's room. My first real thought. That night the light was on in Ben's room, and someone was talking. I wanted to stop thinking about it, but I always came back to it. Why would a crazed killer go into Ben's room, close the door, turn on the light, and chat? The light was on in Ben's room. Forget the other stuff. A vengeful Lou Cates, a debt-crazed Runner, a pack of goons who wanted to teach Runner a lesson by murdering his family. Forget the bellowing voice I heard, which, fine, I guess, may not have been Ben's. But he wasn't home when we went to bed, and when I woke up, the light was on. I remember a flush of relief because Ben was home, because his light was on, and the fight was over between him and my mom, at least for today, because the light was on, and he was talking behind the door, maybe on his new phone, or to himself, but the light was on. And who was Deandra? I prepared to get out of bed, tossing the covers aside, the sheets dank-smelling, gray from my body. I wondered how long it had been since I'd changed them. And then I wondered how often you were supposed to change them. These were the kinds of things you didn't learn. I changed the bedclothes after sex now, finally, and that I only learned a few years ago from a movie on TV. Glenn Close, some thriller, and she's just had sex and is changing the sheets, and I can't remember the rest, because all I was thinking was, oh, I guess people change sheets after they have sex. It made sense, but I'd never thought of it. I was raised feral, and I mostly stayed that way. I got out of bed, finally returning the lamp to my bed table, and walked roundabout to the living room, sneaking up on the answering machine, not letting it know I cared if it had a message. I might as well have whistled, my feet kicking out ahead of me. "Nothing unusual here. Just out for a walk." No Diane. 4 days, and no Diane. Well, no problem. I had other family. Ben was waiting for me this time when I came, sliding into view before I was prepared. He sat rigid in the seat behind glass, his eyes unfocused, a jumpsuited mannequin. I wanted to tell him not to do that to me. It gave me the creeps. But I didn't say anything, because why would he give me the creeps, unless I still didn't entirely believe he was innocent? Which I didn't, I guess. I sat down, the chair still humid from someone else, the warmth of the plastic feeling grossly intimate in this place. I mushed my buttocks back and forth, making it mine, trying not to look repulsed. But when I picked up the phone, it was still sweaty from the previous user, and whatever look I gave made Ben frown. "You okay?" he asked, and I nodded once. "Yes, sure, absolutely fine."
"So you came back," he said.
He fixed on a smile now, cautious, the way Ben always was. At a family party on the last day of school, he looked the same. A kid who lived permanently in the library, waiting to be shushed. I came back. He had a nice face. Not handsome, but nice. The face of a good guy. Catching me assessing him, his eyes darted to his hands. They were big now, bigger than his small frame. Piano hands, even though we never played piano. They were scarred, nothing impressive. Dark pink confetti strips of nips and cuts.
He caught me looking, held one hand up, pointed a finger at one deep gash. Polo accident. I laughed because I could tell he was already regretting the joke.
Nah, actually, you know what this is? Ben said. This is from that bull, Yellow 5. Remember that little bastard?
We had only a small operation, but we still never named our cattle. That was not a good idea. Even as a kid, I had no interest in getting attached to Bossy or Hank or Sweet Belle, because they'd be sent to slaughter as soon as they were big enough. 16 months, that rang out in my head. Once they were a year old, you started tiptoeing around them. You started looking at them sideways with disgust and embarrassment, like a guest in your home who just farted. So instead, we color-tagged them during calving each year, matching cows with their calves. Green 1, red 3, blue 2, sliding out from their mothers onto the dirt floor of the barn. Those feet kicking right away, always trying to get a purchase in the slop. People think of cattle as docile, dumb, but calves? They're kitty curious, playful. And for that reason, I was never allowed in the lot with them, just eyed them through the slats. But I remember Ben, his rubber boots on, trying to sneak, moving slow and deliberate as an astronaut. And then he got near, and he might as well have been trying to grab fish. I remember Yellow 5, at least the name, the famous bull calf who'd refused to be castrated. Poor Ben and my mom, day after day trying to get a hold of Yellow 5 so they could slit his sack and cut off his nuts, and each day coming to the dinner table as failures, Yellow 5 having outplayed them. It was a joke to be told over a ground round the first night, everyone talking to the steak, pretending it was Yellow 5. You'll be sorry, Yellow 5. By the second night, it was cause for chagrined laughter. And by the fifth, it was grim mouths and silence, a reminder to both Ben and my mom that they weren't good enough. Weak, small, slow, lacking. I'd have never thought of Yellow 5 again without Ben reminding me. I wanted to tell him to make a list of things to recall, memories I couldn't pluck out of my brain on my own. What happened? He bit you?
Nah, nothing that dramatic. He pushed me into the fence right when I thought I'd gotten a hold of him, just haunched me to one side, and I fell full on, jammed the back of my hand right onto a nail. It was on a rail Mom had already asked me to fix a good 5 times. So, you know, my fault. I was trying to think of what to say. Something clever, commiserative. I still had no grip on what reactions Ben wanted. And Ben interrupted.
No, screw that. It was goddamn Yellow 5's fault.
He broke into a quick smile, then let his shoulders slump down again. I remember Debbie. She dressed it all up, my cut, put a Band-Aid on it, and then put one of her stickers, those shiny stickers with, like, hearts or whatever, on top of it.
She loved stickers, I said.
She put them everywhere, that's for sure.
I took a breath, debated flitting over to some other harmless subject, the weather or something, then didn't.
Hey, Ben, can I ask you a question?
He went shark-eyed, tight, and I saw the convict again, a guy used to being on the receiving end, taking question after question and getting attitude when he asked his own. I realized what a decadence it was to refuse to answer a question.
No thanks, don't want to talk about that. And the worst you get is someone thinks you're rude.
You know, that night?
He widened his eyes.
Of course he knew the night.
I remember I may have been confused about exactly what happened. He was leaning forward now, his arms stiff, huddled over the phone like it was a late-night emergency call. But one thing I do remember, like stake my life on it, remember. Your light was on. In your bedroom. I saw it under the crack in the door, and there was talking. In the room. I trailed off, hoping he'd save me. He let me float. That free-fall few seconds when your feet go loose on ice and you have just enough time to think, oh, I am going to fall.
That's a new one, he finally said.
What's that?
A new question. I didn't think there'd be new questions anymore. Congratulations.
I caught us both sitting in the same posture, one palm on the edge of the table, like we were about to push back from a meal of leftovers. Runner's posture. I remember it from the last time I saw him. Me, 25 or 26, and him wanting money, asking all flirty and sweet at first.
Do you think maybe you could help your old man out, Libby dear?
And me telling him no, straight off. A bat cracking a line drive. Shocking. Humbling.
Well, why not?
He'd snapped, and his shoulders shot back. His arms flipped up, hands on my table, me thinking, why'd I let him sit down? Already calculating the time I'd waste, getting him back up.
I snuck out that night, Ben said. I came home. Me and Mom got in another fight.
About Chrissy Cates? He started at that, then let it slide over him.
About Chrissy Cates. But she believed me. She was completely on my side. That was the great thing about Mom. Even when she was pissed as hell at you, she was on your side. You knew that. In your bones. She believed me. But she was angry and just scared. I'd kept her waiting for, I don't know, 16 hours with no word. I didn't even know what was going on, you know? No cell phones back then. You'd go a whole day and not talk. Not like today, I hear.
So... But,
right, we just got in a fight. I don't remember if it was exactly Chrissy Cates or that's where it started and went from there. I wish to God I could remember. But anyway, she kind of grounds me, sends me to my room, and I go there, and after an hour, I'm pissed off again. And I leave the house, leave the radio on and the lights on, so if she peeks out, she thinks I'm still there. I mean, you know the way she slept. Wasn't like she was going to walk all the way to my room to look in on me. Once she was asleep, she was pretty much asleep.
Ben made it sound like an unbelievable journey, those 30-some steps. But it was true. My mom was useless once she was asleep. She barely even moved. I remember holding tense vigils over her body, convincing myself she was dead, staring till my eyes watered, trying to make out breathing. Trying to get even a moan. Nudge her, and she'd flop back into the same position. We all had stories of encountering her on coincidental overlapping visits to the bathroom in the night. Turn the corner to find her peeing on the toilet, robe between her legs, looking through us like we were made of glass. I just don't know about the sorghum, she'd say. Or, that seed come in yet? And then she'd shuffle past us, back to her room. Did you tell the police that?
Aw, Libby, come on, come on. This is not how I want this to go.
Did you?
No, I didn't. What difference would it have made? They already knew we had a fight. I tell them we had two. There's no point. I was there maybe an hour. Nothing happened besides that. It was inconsequential. Entirely.
We eyed each other. Who's Deandra? I asked. I could see him try to go even more still. I could see him thinking. The sneaking out may have been true, may not, but I could tell now he was about to lie. The name Deandra chimed him. I could picture his bones humming. He tilted his head to the right just a little bit. A funny you ask that, tilt, and caught himself.
Deandra?
He was stalling, trying to figure out exactly what I knew. I gave him a face of slab.
Deandra was a girl at school. Where'd you come up with Deandra?
I found a note she wrote you. Sounds like she was more than a girl at school.
Huh. Well, she was a crazy girl, I do remember that. She was always writing notes that, you know... She was a girl who wanted people to think she was wild.
I thought you didn't have a girlfriend. I didn't. Jeez, Libby, how do you go from a note to a girlfriend?
From the note. I tensed up, knowing I was about to be disappointed.
Well, I don't know what to tell you. I wish I could say she was my girlfriend. She was just totally out of my league. I don't even remember getting a note from her. Are you sure it had my name on it? And how do you even get a note?
Never mind, I said, removing the phone from my ear so he knew I was leaving.
Libby, hold on, hold on.
No, if you're going to work me like some convict, I don't see the point.
Libby, hold the hell up. I'm sorry I can't give you the answer I guess you want.
I just want the truth.
And I just want to tell you the truth, but you seem to want a story. Christ, here comes my little sister after all these years, and I think, well, here might be one good thing. One good thing. She sure as hell wasn't helpful 24 goddamn years ago, but hey, I'm over that. I'm so over that the first time I see her, all I am is happy. I mean, there I was in my fucking animal pen, waiting to see you, so nervous like I was going on a date. And I see you, and geez, it's like, maybe this one thing will be okay. Maybe I can have one person from my family still in my life, and I won't be so fucking lonely. Because, and I mean, I know you talked to Magda. Believe me, I heard all about that. And so, yeah, I have people who visit me and care about me, but they're not you. They're not anyone who knows me, except as the guy with the... And I was just thinking it'd be so goddamn nice to be able to talk with my sister, who knows me, who knows our family, and knows we were just, like, normal. And we can laugh about goddamn cows. That's it, you know? That's all I'm asking for at this point. Just something as tiny as that. And so I wish I could tell you something that won't make you... hate me again.
He dropped his eyes, looking at the reflection of his chest in the glass.
But I can't.
Ben Day, January 2, 1985, 5:58 p.m. Deandra had a little belly. It freaked Ben out, and for weeks now she'd been talking about the quickening. The quickening had happened. The baby was moving. It was a very special, important moment, and so Ben had to put his hand on her stomach all the time and feel the baby kick. He was proud of making the belly, proud of making the baby. The idea of it, at least. But he didn't like to actually touch that area or look at it. The flesh was weird, hard but globby at the same time, like ham gone bad, and touching it was just embarrassing. For weeks, she'd been grabbing his hand and pressing it there, watching his face for a reaction, and then she'd yell at him when he couldn't feel anything. For a while, actually, he'd thought maybe the pregnancy was just one of Deandra's jokes to make him feel dumb. He'd sit there with his hand sweating on that gross mound of skin and think, maybe that rumble, was that it? Was that the baby? Or was that just indigestion? He worried. He worried that if he didn't feel anything, and he hadn't those first weeks after the quickening, that Deandra would yell at him. It's right there. It's like a cannon going off in my womb. How can you not feel it? And he worried that if he finally said he did, that Deandra would blast him with her laugh, that laugh that bowed her at the midsection like she'd been shot, the knee-grabbing laugh that made her gelled hair shake like a tree after an ice storm. Because, of course, she wasn't really pregnant. She was just fucking with him. Didn't he know anything? He had, in fact, looked for signs she may be lying. Those big, bloody maxi pads that his mom always rolled up in the trash and that always ended up unfurled within a day. Otherwise, he hadn't been sure what to look for, and he wasn't sure if he should ask if it was his. She talked like it was, and that was probably as sure as he'd get. Anyway, in the past month, it was clear she was definitely pregnant, at least if you saw her naked. She still went to school, dressed in those giant baggy sweaters, and she left her jeans unbuttoned and partly unzipped, and the mound got bigger, Deandra holding it and rubbing it in her hands like it was some sort of crystal ball of their fucked-up future. And one day, she grabbed his hand and he felt it. No doubt. That thing was kicking, and all of a sudden he saw the swipe of a little foot move under the surface of Deandra's skin, smooth and fast. "What the hell's wrong with you? You birth cows out there at the farm, don't you? It's just a baby," was Deandra's reaction when he snatched his hand away. She pulled it back and held it there, held his palm on that twitching thing inside her, and he thought, "Calving is damn different than your own real baby." And then he thought, "Let me go, let me go, let me go," as if the thing were going to grab him like some late-night slasher movie and pull him inside her. That's how he pictured it, a thing, not a baby. Maybe it would have helped if they talked about it more. After the quickening, she wouldn't speak to him at all for a few days, and it turned out he was supposed to give her something for the quickening, that you gave pregnant ladies presents to celebrate the quickening, and that her parents had given her a gold bracelet when she got her first period, and that this was like that. So in place of a present, she made him go down on her 10 times. That was the deal, which he thought she probably picked because he didn't really like to do it. The smell made him queasy, especially now, when that whole area seemed used. She didn't seem to like it either. That's why it felt like punishment. Her yelling at him about fingers and pressure and higher. It's higher up, go higher. And finally sighing and grabbing his head hard by the ears and pulling him to the spot she wanted, and him thinking, "You fucking bitch," and wiping her off his mouth when he was done. 8 more to go, you fucking bitch. You want a glass of water, sweetheart? And she'd said, "No, but you do. You smell like pussy," and laughed. Pregnant women were moody. He knew this. But otherwise, Deandra didn't act pregnant. She still smoked and drank, which you weren't supposed to do if you were pregnant, but she said only health nuts gave up all that stuff. Another thing she didn't do. Plan. Deandra didn't even talk much about what they'd do when it was born, when she was born. Deandra had never been to a doctor, but she was sure it was a girl because girls made you sicker, and she'd been sick the first month so bad. But she really didn't say more, reality-wise, than to talk about it as a girl, as an actual girl that would come out of her. He'd wondered at first if she was going to get an abortion. He'd said, "If you have the baby," instead of "when," and she'd completely freaked, and Deandra completely freaking was something he never wanted to see again. She was a handful enough at her most calm. This was like watching a natural disaster. The nails, the crying, the hitting, and her yelling that that was the worst thing anyone had ever said to her, and it's your flesh too, what the hell is wrong with you, you asshole piece of shit. But otherwise, they didn't plan, or couldn't plan, since Deandra's dad would literally kill her if he ever found out she was pregnant outside of marriage. If he ever found out she even did it outside of marriage, he'd kill her. Deandra's parents had only one rule, only one single rule, and that was that she must never, ever let a boy touch her there unless he was her husband. When she turned 16, Deandra's dad had given her a promise ring, a gold ring with a big red stone that looked like a wedding ring, and she wore it on that finger, and it meant a promise to him and to herself that she would remain a virgin till marriage. The whole thing grossed Ben out. Doesn't that seem like you're married to your dad? Deandra said it was a control thing, mostly. This was the one thing her dad had decided to get hung up about, and it was the one thing he asked of her, and goddammit, she'd better do it. She said it made him feel better leaving her alone, unsupervised, unprotected, except for the dogs, for months at a time. It was his one parental thing. My daughter may drink or do drugs, but she is a virgin, and therefore I can't be as fucked up as I seem. This, she said, with tears in her eyes. This, she said, while near her pass-out part of a drunk. She said her dad told her if he ever found out she'd broken the promise, he'd take her out of the house and shoot her in the head. Her dad had been in Vietnam, and he talked like that, and Deandra took it seriously, so she didn't do any planning about the baby. Ben made lists of things they might need, and he bought some hand-me-down baby clothes at Adelfo's flea market right near Christmas time. He'd been embarrassed, so he just bought the whole bunch from the woman for $8. It turned out to be undershirts and underwear for a bunch of different ages, lots of roughly undies. The woman kept calling them bloomers, which is fine. Kids need underwear for sure. Ben stored them under his bed, which made him more glad he had the lock. He could picture the girls finding them and stealing whatever fit. So true, he didn't think enough about the kid and what would happen, but Deandra seemed to think even less. "I think we should leave town," Deandra said now. A surprise, the hair still over half her face, Ben's hand still clamped to her belly, the baby scuttering around inside like it had dug tunnels. Deandra turned slightly toward him, one lazy boob lolling on Ben's arm. "I can't hide this much longer. My mom and dad will be home any day now. You sure Michelle doesn't know?" Ben had saved a note from Deandra. It talked about how horny she was and how much sex she wanted from him, even now, and nosy-ass Michelle had found it going through his jacket pockets. The little bitch had blackmailed him, $10 not to tell Mom, and when Ben complained to Deandra, she went ballistic. "Your little fucking sister could tell on us at any moment. You think that's okay? This is on you, Ben. You fucked up." Deandra was paranoid that somehow Michelle would figure out she was pregnant from those two words, "even now," and they'd be undone by a fucking 10-year-old. How perfect. "No, she hasn't mentioned it again." That was a lie. Just yesterday, Michelle caught his eye, shook her hips, and said in a teasy voice, "Hey, Ben, how's your sex life?" She was such a shitty kid. She'd blackmailed him on other things, chores he'd left undone, extra food he'd eaten from the fridge. Little stuff. It was always little crappy stuff, like she was there just to remind Ben how cramped his life was. She'd spend the money on jelly donuts. Trey made a loud loogie noise in the other room, and then a thweep spit sound. Ben could picture the yellow phlegm dripping down the sliding glass door, the dogs licking at it. That was something Trey and Deandra did. They hawked loogies at things. Sometimes Trey shot it straight into the air, and the dogs would catch it in their drooly mouths. "It's just body stuff going into another body," Deandra would say. "You've thrown some of your body stuff into my body, and it doesn't seem to bother you none." As the TV got even louder in the den, "Wrap it up, you two, I'm goddamn bored." Ben tried to think of the right thing to say. He sometimes thought he never said anything to Deandra that was just pure talking. It was all verbal elbows and arms, trying to fend off her constant annoyance, say what she wanted to hear. But he loved her. He did love her. And that's what men did for their women. They told them what they wanted to hear and shut up. He'd knocked Deandra up, and now she owned him, and he had to do right by her. He'd have to drop out of school and get a full-time job, which would be fine. Some kid he knew quit last year and worked over near Abilene at the brick factory, got $12,000 a year. Ben couldn't even begin to think how to spend it all. So he'd drop out of school, which was just as well, considering whatever the hell Deandra thought she'd heard about Chrissy Cates. It was weird. At first that made him really nervous, that those rumors were going around, and then part of him got kind of proud. Even though she was a kid, she was one of the cool younger kids. Even some of the high schoolers knew her. The older girls took an interest in her, that pretty, well-bred girl, so it was sort of cool that she had a crush on him, even though she was a kid, and he was sure whatever Deandra had just told him was her usual exaggeration. Hysterical, she sometimes got. "Hey, hello? Try to stay with me. I said I think we have to leave town." "Then we'll leave town." He tried to kiss her, and she pushed him away. "Really? That easy? Where do we go? How will you support us? I won't have my allowance anymore, you know. You'll have to get a job." "I'll get a job then. What about your uncle or cousin or whoever in Wichita?" She looked at him like he was crazy. With the sporting goods store? He pushed. You can't work there. You're 15. You can't drive. In fact, I don't even think you can get a real job without your mom's permission. When do you turn 16 again? July 13th, he said, feeling like he'd just told her he wet himself. She started crying then. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. What are we going to do? Your cousin can't help? My uncle will tell my parents. How will that help? She got up, walking naked, her stomach bulge looking dangerously unsupported, Ben wanting to go stick a hand under there and thinking how much bigger she'd get. She didn't put on any clothes to walk across the hall to the shower, even though Trey could see right down the hallway if he was still sitting on the couch. He heard the guttural sound of the shower twisting on. Conversation over. He wiped himself off with a moldy towel near Deandra's hamper, then squeezed back into his leather pants and striped T-shirt and sat on the edge of the bed, trying to guess what smart-ass comment Trey was going to make when they went back out to the den. In a few minutes, Deandra breezed into the bedroom, wearing a red towel, her hair wet, not looking at him, and sat in front of her dresser with the mirror in it. She squirted her mousse into her palm, a giant dog shit of a pile, and scrunched it into her hair, aiming the blow dryer at each section. Squirt, scrunch, whoosh. Squirt, scrunch, whoosh. He wasn't sure whether he was supposed to leave or not, so he stayed, sitting on the bed still, trying to catch her eye. She poured dark foundation into her palm, the way an artist might pour paint, and swirled it onto her face. Some girls had called her a base face, he heard them, but he liked the way it looked. Tan and smooth, even though her neck sometimes seemed whiter, like the vanilla ice cream under the caramel dip. She put on 3 coats of mascara. She always said it took 3, one to darken, one to thicken, and one for drama. Then she started with the lipstick. Undercoat, overcoat, gloss. She caught him looking and stopped, dabbing her lips on little foamy triangles, leaving sticky purple kiss marks on them. You need to ask Runner for money, she said, looking at him in the mirror. My dad? Yeah, he's got money, right? Trey always buys weed from him. She dropped the towel, went over to her underwear drawer, a thicket of bright lace and satin, and dug around till she pulled out underwear and a bra, hot pink with black lace edges, the kind girls wore in the saloons in Westerns. Are you sure we're talking about the same guy? He said. My dad does, you know, handyman stuff, labor. He works on farms and stuff. Deandra rolled her eyes at him, tugging at the back of her bra, her tits overflowing everywhere, over the cups, under the clasps, unwranglable and eggy. She let the bra go finally, threw it across the room. Fuck, I need a goddamn fucking bra that fits. She stood glaring at him, and then her underpants started rolling under themselves, edging away from her stomach, up in her ass crack. None of those sexy underclothes fit. Ben thought first, chubby, and then corrected, pregnant. Are you serious? You don't know your own dad deals? He sold to me and Trey last week. She tossed away the underpants, then put on a different bra, an ugly plain bra, and new jeans, pouting about her size. Ben had never bought drugs himself before. He smoked a lot with Trey and Deandra and whoever had pot in that crowd, and sometimes he chipped in a buck or two. But when he pictured a dealer, he pictured someone with slick hair and jewelry, not his dad in the old Royals baseball cap and the cowboy boots with the big heels and the shirts that looked like they were wilting. Not his dad. Definitely not his dad. And weren't dealers supposed to have money? His dad definitely did not have money. So the whole argument was stupid. And if he was a dealer, and he did have money, he wouldn't give any to Ben. He'd make fun of Ben for asking, maybe hold a 20 just out of Ben's reach, the way a bully would grab a nerd's notebook, and then he'd laugh and shove it right back in his pants pocket. Runner never had a wallet. He just carried mangled bills in the front of his jeans. And wasn't that enough of a sign he had no cash?
Trey!
DeAndre yelled down the hall. She threw on a new sweater with patterns that looked like a geometry experiment, ripped off the tags and tossed them to the floor, then rumbled out of the room. Ben was left staring at the rock posters and the astrology posters. DeAndre was a Scorpio. She took it very seriously. And crystals and books on numerology. All around her mirror were stapled decrepit, dried corsages from dances Ben had not taken her to. They were mostly from this senior back in Hiawatha named Gary, that even Trey said was a prick. Trey, of course, knew him. The corsages unsettled Ben. They looked like organs, with their folds and their twists, their pink and purpleness. They reminded Ben of the stinking globs of meat sitting in his locker right now. A horrible gift DeAndre had left him. Surprise! The girl parts of some animal. DeAndre refusing to say where it came from. She hinted it was from a blood sacrifice she did with Trey. Ben assumed it was just leftover pieces from a biology experiment. She liked to freak him out. When her class did baby pig dissections, she brought him a curlicue tail, thought it was hilarious. It wasn't. It was just nasty. He got up and went to the living room.
You sorry sack of shit,
Trey called from the sofa, where he'd just lit a joint, not taking his eyes off the music video.
You don't know about your dad? The fuck, dude?
Trey's bare stomach was almost concave, but rippled, perfect, tan. The opposite of Ben's soft white mouse belly. Trey had balled the shirt DeAndre gave him under his head as a pillow.
Here, you broke dick dog.
He handed Ben the joint, and Ben took a big pull off it, feeling the back of his head go numb.
Hey, Ben, how many babies does it take to paint a house?
Annihilation. There it was back, that word. Ben pictured barbarian hordes busting through the big stone fireplace and swiping Trey's head off with an axe, right in the middle of one of his fucking dead baby jokes, the head rolling over across the dog shit and stopping next to one of DeAndre's black buckle shoes. And then maybe DeAndre dies next. Fuck it all. Ben took another drag, his brain feeling minty, and gave it back to Trey. DeAndre's biggest dog, the white one, glided over to him and stared with no forgiveness in its eyes.
Depends on how hard you throw them, Trey said. Why do you put a baby in a blender feet first?
I'm serious, Trey, DeAndre said, continuing a conversation Ben wasn't privy to. He thinks his dad doesn't deal.
So you can see its reaction.
Hey,
Ben, you're smoking your dad's stuff, buddy,
Trey said, finally turning to look at him.
It's crap. Potent, but crap. That's why we know your dad has money. He overcharges, but no one else has any right now.
Think he said he got it in Texas.
Been to Texas lately?
Runner had disappeared from Ben's life after Patty gave him the boot. For all Ben knew, he might have gone to Texas for a while. Hell, you can drive to Texas and back in a day if you drive hard, so why not?
This is cashed, Trey said in a toke-choke voice. Anyway, he owes me money, like everyone in this town. They love to make the bet. They never want to pay it off.
Hey, I didn't even get any, DeAndre pouted. She turned away and started sifting through the cabinets. The basement den had a mini-kitchen, too. Imagine that, needing a separate room for all your junk food. And then cracked open the fridge, got herself a beer, didn't ask Ben if he wanted one. Ben saw the inside of that fridge, which had been packed with food the month before, and now just had beer and a big jar with one single pickle floating in it like a turd.
You grab me a beer, DeAndre? He said, pissy.
She cocked her head at him, then handed him hers, went back to the fridge for another.
So let's go find Runner, and we'll get some pot and get some money, DeAndre said, draping herself next to him on the chair. And then we can get the hell out of Dodge.
Ben looked at that blue eye, that bright blue eye. It seemed like DeAndre was always looking at him sideways. He never saw both eyes at the same time. And for the first time, he felt really bone-scared.
He couldn't even drop out of school without his mom's permission before he turned 16. Much less get a job at the brick plant, or anything that made enough money for Deandra to not hate him, not sigh when he came home at night. And now that's what he saw. Not even that little apartment in Wichita, but some factory near the border, near Oklahoma, where the really cheap work was, where you worked 16 hours a day, worked weekends, and Deandra would be with the baby and she'd hate it. She had no mothering instinct. She'd sleep right through the baby crying. She'd forget to feed it. She'd go out drinking with some guys she met. She always was meeting guys, at the mall or the gas station or the movies, and leave the kid there. What can happen to it? It's a baby. It ain't going nowhere. He could already hear it, him being the bad guy, the poor idiot bad guy who can't provide. Fine, he said, thinking once they left the house they'd lose track of the idea. He almost had. His brain was bundling itself up, getting woolly. He wanted to go home. Trey immediately shot up, jingling his truck keys. I know where to find him. And suddenly they were out in the cold, tromping through the snow and ice, Deandra demanding Ben's arm so she wouldn't fall. Ben thinking, but what if she fell? What if she fell and died, or lost the baby? He'd heard girls at school saying if you ate a lemon a day, you'd have a miscarriage, and had thought about sneaking lemon into Deandra's Diet Cokes, and then realized that was wrong, to do it without her knowing. But what if she fell? But she didn't. They were in Trey's truck with the heater whooshing on them, and Ben was in the back seat as always. It was half a back seat, really. Only a kid could fit on it, so his knees were smashed sideways to his chest. And when he saw a shriveled pinky of a fry on the seat next to him, he popped it in his mouth, and instead of looking to see if anyone saw, he just looked for more, which meant he was very stoned and very hungry.